On the blank last page of a choir, somewhere in the middle of a manuscript 553 in the Stiftsbibliothek in the Abbey of St. Gallen, Switzerland, a 9th century scribe penned down the genealogies of the saints Gall, Patrick, and Bridget. This text, disqualified by its subsequent editors as fabulous, is a remarkable witness to the continental memory of these three particular saints in the Carolingian period. It demonstrates the use and the perceived power of ancestries in the positioning of holy men. The lineage of Gall appears to be at the center of the genealogist's attention, because he's the first to be mentioned, and the treatment he receives may prove to be the key to understanding the use of collective memory in this particular text. Gall's heritage is established in this text as one of royal blood as well as of humble means. And this may have been directed at the inmates of the Abbey of St. Gallen, as an origin from poor ancestors fitted the humility prescribed in a modern Carolingian monastery, whereas the royal lineage would have resonated with the inmates who themselves were more and more noble of stock, and who, as Heinz Lohe postulated, might have wanted to distinguish their patron saint from the contemporary poor and huddled masses of Irish peregrini. In addition to this humility and the royal descent, there's one other important aspect, I think, and that's the combination. The combination of these three saints within one text is perhaps the most striking feature. A connection is offered by the genealogist between Bridget and Gall. Both are said to descend from the same royal lineage. But by including Patrick, the text's main result is a perceived strong connection between the patron saint of the abbey in which this manuscript was housed with the two main saints of Ireland. And more than in hagiography, it implicitly but clearly classifies Gall as an Irish saint among Irish saints. This raises questions about the role of the Irish heritage of these missionaries in the ways they were remembered on the continent in the Carolingian period. In a period that saw some conspicuous immigration from Ireland, how did continental scholars and scribes incorporate the Irish origin of these peregrini of old within their collective memories? In this paper, I should like to explore the various ways that the Irish background features in Carolingian memory. And although from my initial title, you can see that my ambition was somewhat larger than I can actually fulfill here right now. Saints kept dropping like flies when I tried to incorporate them into a paper that lasted 20 minutes. So in fact, I'm only going to give you a brief explorative study of some aspects of the continental memory of two prominent Irish saints, Columbanus and his one-time companion, Gall. Now, the most influential of Irish wandering holy men is arguably St. Columbanus, founder of four monasteries on the continent, including the influential houses of Luxeuil and Bobbio. The lasting influence of Columbanus's foundation and their string of Luxeuil-centered houses accounts for the durable memory of the saint himself. The ruling elite did not fail to notice this prominence within the monastic landscape, and following Charlemagne's assumption of the Lombard throne in 774, the new king perceived the importance of the last of Columbanus's foundations, Bobbio, which housed the relics of the saint. And the subsequent royal largesse directed at the Abbey of Bobbio accounts for most of the references to Columbanus in this era. In charters recording gifts to the monastery, the founding saint is routinely mentioned, although, without exception, these charters fail to refer his origin from Ireland. It's usually just Columbanus who lies here in Bobbio, etc., etc. So Columbanus features in these legal documents solely within the context dictated by his continental foundation, a holy man identified in a reciprocal relation to his monastery. The identity is tied to his achievements on the continent. And this is echoed in Carolingian narrative sources, such as the one chapter in the continuation of the Chronicle of Fredegar that records Columbanus's activities. This chapter relates Columbanus's dealings with the Burgundian king Theuderic II and his grandmother Brunhild. This episode must have been much to the liking of the Carolingian audience, as it depicts the holy man in a bitter dispute over the lax morals of a now defunct Merovingian royal family. Let's see. There we go. It actually starts exactly with this. It only relates this particular passage in Colin Baines' life. Colin Baines is introduced as a holy man within a continental context, a saint whose reputation was increasing everywhere in the cities and provinces of Gaul and Germany. His Irish heritage is not mentioned once, not even through the use of an innocuous adjective. The only trace of evidence of his connection to Ireland is the use of the word return, repedare, when Colin Baines, having been expelled by Theuderic, is planning to leave the continent for Ireland. Other narrative sources from the Carolingian period mentioning Colin Baines, such as the Gesta Abbatum Fontanalentium and Paul the Deacon's History of the Lombards, equally disregard his heritage from Ireland, but focus exclusively on his work on the continent. A striking break with this routine is found in one of the poems of Charlemagne's prominent Northumbrian scholar, Alcman. One of his Carmina, number 110 in Dümmler's MGH edition, is principally a litany of apostles, martyrs, confessors, and saints. And it would seem a somewhat eclectic mix of holy men, and actually it is, with little obvious organization, until the verses following the mention of blessed men such as Thaddeus, Simon of Felix, Samson, Apollinaris, and Martha Gregory, so again, very eclectic. But then Alcuin writes, Patrick, Kieran, the glory of the people of the Irish, and Columbanus, Comgall, and Adovnan, illustrious fathers, teachers of morals and life, may their piety help us all here through prayers. And then he goes on, this altar is dedicated to holy virgins whose life was famous throughout the towns of the Irish. Bridget, holy woman, and also Ita, faithful in Christ, they administer salvation through holy intercession. Now, this snippet view of Irish holy life groups together a number of Irish saints, plus Patrick, while no such explicit clustering along ethnic or geographical lines is found elsewhere in the poem. So this treatment is reserved for the Irish saints. And the choice of names is intriguing in itself. Apart from Columbanus, none of these blessed people has a connection to the continent. And while Adovnan is mentioned, Columba is conspicuously missing. Now, that Alcuin, as a Northumbrian, had knowledge of these Irish saints is perhaps not very surprising, but their fame on the continent must have been very limited. The poet clearly identifies the saints as holy men and women constituting the glory of the people of the Irish, and their regional confines are established by the remark that their lives and their lives are famous throughout the towns of the Irish, urbe scotorum. One could argue that this aspect is even underscored by the prominent use of the word hic, here in the line reading, hic precibus pietas horum nos adjuvat omnes. By entreating their intercession here, Alcuin seems to emphasize their origin there. It is such phrases that could be seen to qualify these blessed men and women as distinctly Irish saints with a limited presence on the universal stage. And this is compounded by the sentence immediately following these lines, which is adding insult to injury, I guess, declaring that St. Martin is honoured throughout the world, rather than simply receiving fame throughout the towns of Ireland. This grouping together of Irish saints, explicitly classifying these peregrini, or these Irish saints actually, by their Irish heritage, can be observed in some instances in the Carolingian manuscript traditions, but only very few, exactly as James said, only very few of the early manuscript witnesses of for instance, Jonas's life of Colin Baines and his disciples survive, so we should be very careful with the evidence that we derive thereof. The most important extant early copies are the St. Gall manuscript just mentioned earlier and a late 9th century manuscript, number 1, at the Grand Seminaire at Metz. As recent historians have stressed, the work of Jonas is an intricate composition composed for a delicate task to honour Colin Baines while deflecting attention from the most damaging of accusations levelled at the saint. But at the same time, Jonas manages to stress the continuity between Colin Baines and his successors, including the leaders of more recently founded houses in the Columbanian fold, who are exactly the people who recognised Colin Baines's errors and faults, and had made changes to his Easter reckoning and monastic rule. So Jonas achieved this dual endeavour by structuring his work in two books, one on Colin Baines' proper, and the other including the lives of Athala, Eustasius, the goings-on at Fermoucce, and stories of the monks of Colombanus during the abbacies of Athala and Bertulf. Now, although the life itself does not gloss over Colombanus' Irish heritage, the entire construction aims to emphasize his position as a universal, or at least Western European, saint within a continental context, as the founder of a rich monastic tradition covering almost the entire western half of the continent. In St. Gallen manuscript 553, a humble but neat manuscript written at the Abbey of St. Gallen by a number of different scribes, this features Jonas's work complete with the Vita Columbani, the Vita Athale, the Vita Bertulfi, and De Monachis Ebobiensibus, so omitting the section on Fermoucce, and it is followed by liturgical and hagiographical material on St. Gall, a contemporary copy of homilies on the festival of St. Gall, the aforementioned genealogy linking Irish saints, and Vetti's life of St. Gall, on which later more. But you can see here in a nice picture already. In its current arrangement, the memory of Columbanus and his associates is therefore closely linked with Gaul. It is perhaps not surprising for a manuscript originating from St. Gallen, a monastery whose identity was closely linked with Gaul's association with Columbanus. And this combination is actually found in some later manuscripts as well. But the arrangement in the other 9th century manuscript witness to the Vita Columbani, the Metz manuscript, breaks with this convention. This book, from the writing school of Reims during the office of Archbishop Hincmar, has virtually the same corpus of Jonas's text on Columbanus, but its associated contents link Columbanus with another Irishman, Columba. For this manuscript has the second oldest copy of Out of Nones Life of Columba. Now, while the association of Columbanus with Gaul can be explained by their alleged cooperation in life, there is no formal link between Columba and Columbanus to justify this duet, apart from perhaps the similarity of their names. This peculiar combination leaves us guessing what their relationship is thought to have been, but we can arguably agree that the arrangement in this manuscript seems to identify Columbanus as an Irish saint who is remembered in the company of that other big Irish saint, Columba. Now, I'd like to move on to St. Gall, because other than Columbanus, the Carolingian memory of St. Gall is dominated by the various new vitae composed in this period. The earliest life, the so-called Vita Sancti Galli Fetus Dissima, was written sometime around 680 and revised again around 720 and 771. And a second life of St. Gall, following quite quickly afterwards, and the first to survive complete, was written at the request of Abbot Gottsbert by the Reichenau teacher Vetti, who died in 824. In writing this Vita Sancti Galli, Vetti closely followed the model of the Fetus Dissima. The first chapters of Book 1 are devoted to the travels of Columbanus and reinforce Gaul's association with the Columbanian mission. One would expect this to be a suitable opportunity to recount the Irish context of Columbanus and the origins shared by Gallus and Columbanus. But the author is, in fact, remarkably cursory on the subject. Vetti's work features no description of Ireland's geographical position or even its religious, social, or intellectual circumstances. And there's also no elaboration on Gallus's Irish roots, with the exception of the guarded mention in the opening sections that Gallus spent the flower of his youth in Ireland. That's the Vetus Dissima. And that's the flower of his youth, leaving open the possibility that Gallus had come from overseas, like the many Englishmen, for instance, described by Bede. The only instance where the saint himself is identified as an Irishman occurs in a short phrase of indirect speech in which the father of a healed girl describes to King Sigebert the man responsible for his daughter's recuperation as an Irishman named Gall. A third life is written by Walfried Strabo in 833, adapting the contents and style of both the Vetus Dissima and Vetti's life, and also entering some new additions. In a passage unique to his version, Walfried unequivocally identifies Gallus as an Irishman when he relates of a sick Irish traveller stranded at the Abbey of St. Gallen, who is said to have remarked somewhat grumbling, I assume, that he believed that the higher purpose of his sickness was that Gallus's glory would and renown would be revealed also to the men of your own people, and not only to barbarians. Another interesting innovation of Walafrid's is the short description of Ireland in the preface of the text, and it actually follows a much longer description of Alemannia, but there's also a short bit on Ireland. It has no parallel in the older Vitae. It's based solely on Salinas, but Walafrid ends the passage with a twist. And he says, "From the rising of the sun in India or Ethiopia, unto its setting among the Britons and Scots, the name of the Lord is now praised. For the Lord is exalted above all the peoples, and his glory above the heavens." The function of Ireland in Walafrid's life appears to be to emphasize the distance between the departure point of Gaul and Columbanus and St. Gallen, and to lay stress on how far the saint had had to travel to save the multitudes of Alemannia. The image of Ireland as a land where the sun sets is especially important, for it reinforces Ireland's position at the end of the world and therefore the truly worldwide spread of Christianity. As Walafrid writes, "It is indeed fitting that he whom the Lord chose from the farthest ends of the earth to bring us salvation should be made known throughout the world by our praises." The same geographical focus as in Walafrid's Vita is demonstrated in the open letter to Abbot Grimald of St. Gallen by Ermenrich of Elwangen. His description of Ireland opens with, "How could we not speak of the island of Ireland, which lies between Spain and Britain, from whence we received the radiance of such great light?" The opening of this sentence appears to sum up the connection and the gratitude felt by the former inmate of St. Gallen towards Ireland. But closer reading of this passage on Ireland reveals that Ermenrich here taps into a second-hand discourse, although he gives it his own twist. The great light in Ermenrich's sentence could be the figure of God, although the next sentence seems to demonstrate that he thought more in general terms about faith. He analogizes this great light radiating from Ireland to the biblical story about the sun turning backwards by 10 degrees in the reign of King Ezechias. He elaborates that the land, Ireland, which only saw the Sol Justitiae setting because it had not yet received the Lumen Fidei, now through God's grace was able to project its light to other people. The farthest corner of the known world was now brought into the light of Christendom and repaid the world by sharing that light through the mission with other parts, in this case, Alemannia. In addition to Walafrid, Ermenrich partly recycles this motif from his own earlier work on the Anglo-Saxon hermit and companion of Boniface, Saint Suwalo, or sometimes Solus or Sola, or Sol. When describing St. Suwalo's decision to leave Britain for the continent in the company of Boniface, Ermenrich uses the same imagery and paints it as the sun's withdrawal of its most radiant light from his native land, of Suwalo's native land. In fact, Ermenrich uses the same word, jubar, radiance, as in his letter to Grimald, and obviously makes the most of Suwalo's Latinized name, Solus or Sol, in his figure of speech. Ermenrich's knack for the esoteric arena of exegesis, as Linda Kuhn called it, and his preference for mystical and allegorical explanations of geography is also evident in his description of Ireland, taking over Bede's description of the island, and thus stating that because of Ireland's latitude and favorable winds, it surpassed Britain in that snow rarely stays on the ground longer than 3 days, and therefore the storage of hay in the summer or the building of stables is unnecessary. And he goes on that the scent of the air is fatal to snakes, even those arriving on the island in boats from other countries, and almost everything from this island is good against potions, even the leaves of books, the scrapings of which, mixed with water and given to drink, can be used as an antidote to poison. Maybe that's one of the reasons why we don't have so many Irish manuscripts that have all been drunk. This land, Bede and Ermenrich conclude, is truly a land of plenty. Other than Bede, Ermenrich, perhaps understandably, does not settle for the literary meaning of this description. Instead, he offers allegorical readings of each of these passages' sentences. He remarks on the mild climate, for instance, and the absence of fierce cold in the light of Proverbs 31:21. She shall not fear for her house in the cold of snow, for all her domestics are clothed in double garments. And then he goes on that the church's doctores have two garments, the Old and the New Testament, with which there must be no fear that their house can be overthrown by the cold of heretics or schismatics, and so on and so on. So to Ermenrich, and to a lesser explicit extent to Walafrid, the Irish heritage of St. Gall was mainly an invitation to allegories and digressions to highlight the history of salvation, mirroring Gall's travels from Ireland to the travels of the Semo Divinus to the continent from the periphery. The case of Columbanus and Gall suggests that the Carolingian memory of the Irish saints appears to have handled their Irish heritage with some flexibility. The Irish element can be wholly ignored, such as in the continuations of the Chronicle of Fredegar, and similarly in the most of the hagiography, the actual lives, especially the older lives. They mostly pertain to contemporary continental concerns of the continental heirs of the saintly protagonists. Then there is the possibility of using Ireland in order to allegorize on much of a lot of esoteric topics, as we see in Walafrid and Ermenrich. And thirdly, at times Carolingian scribes and scholars actually remember the Irish heritage as the source of their interrelation and the useful aspect to categorize them. And we see the genealogist doing that, as well as Alcuin, and we see parts of that in the Metz manuscript. Now, in an earlier article, I suggested that especially people close to the Carolingian court were interested in emphasizing this Irish heritage of the protagonist, which could also work in this in this instance. Obviously, the figure of Alcuin is very prominent in this case. On the other hand, we might also have to look at the position of the wave of self-identified Irish peregrini in exactly this period and what this does to the memory of the Irish saints and missionaries. So, to conclude, much more work obviously needs to be done in order to get a better understanding of the identity of peregrini, and this better understanding could shed more and new light on the reception of foreign culture during the Carolingian revival of learning. Thank you.